Ramon Broadcast Center. This is Take Two. May Martinez. The Bobcat fire has burned over 50,000 acres and now is threatening the cabins of Big Santa Anita Canyon.
All these almost hobbit homes. Picture a glade full of stone wooden cabins scattered throughout the trees.
We'll hear how close the flames are ahead on Take Two. Stay with us. From 89.3 KPCC and streaming at kpcc.org, this is Take Two. I'm A. Martinez. Thanks for joining us. Coming up in just a little bit, we're going to talk to the head of the LAUSD, Austin Buettner, about how the second largest public school system in the country is launching an ambitious COVID-19 testing program. But first, all right, let's talk census, because for weeks now, census takers or enumerators have been hitting the streets of Los Angeles to make sure Angelenos are filling out the 2020 census. Why are efforts to reach everyone so important? Well, census data helps determine everything from political representation to federal funding for public services. And LA County is considered hard to count. Self-response to the census has been low in many LA communities. Take just one, for example, the city of Linwood. So far, only 61% of residents there have responded to the census on their own. Our columnist Eric Galindo went to Linwood recently to talk to people there about the importance of the census. Now, Eric, you spoke to several people there last week. What did you find out?
Yeah, thanks. I spoke to about a dozen people at Plaza Mexico, which is this shopping center. A bit over half said they'd filled out the census, but many of them said they only did so at the urging of a census taker who went to their home and helped them fill it out. And this is an important distinction because the Trump administration has made efforts to shorten the constitutionally mandated census by about a month. It was supposed to have ended October 31st, and last month they bumped the deadline up to September 30th. This is being fought in federal court right now. A federal judge has said the census should keep going, but it's just a temporary order for now. So the door-to-door efforts by census takers that could be cut early are important because they help mitigate undercounts in marginalized communities, especially in Black and brown communities like Linwood, places where people might not have broadband access, or they rent and change addresses, or there's a language barrier. And that process has already been cut short by the pandemic. And until a judge intervened this month, some census takers in hard-to-count LA were already being laid off.
And that broadband access, Eric, that you mentioned is so important. I mean, I'm lucky enough to have good internet at home, so once it was time to do it, I did it. It was over with. But yeah, I can imagine there's a lot of people, as you mentioned, that wouldn't even know to do it or want to do it unless someone prompted them to do it, like those census takers. So why are these communities traditionally hard to count?
Well, one of the reasons is a distrust of the system, of the government in general. I spoke to a man named Carlos who said he'd filled out the census only days ago when a census taker came to his home in Wilmington. I asked Carlos why he hadn't done it on his own before, and he basically said he was afraid. Carlos and his wife are both naturalized U.S. citizens, but he's still worried about being on a list that the Trump administration would have access to. He told me that he still feels vulnerable to being deported somehow.
But we know that U.S. citizens cannot be deported, Eric. So what fuels those fears?
Yeah, the Trump administration's immigration policies have been decidedly anti-immigration, and even legally available avenues like asylum or work visas have been hotly contested. The president has tried to cut family sponsorship and has even questioned birthright citizenship numerous times. And he seems to target immigrant communities in general with his policies and his speech. So far, as people like Carlos are thinking, it's not beyond the realm of possibility that their citizenship would wind up in question. There's that much fear. On top of that, remember that until last year, the Trump administration tried to add a citizenship question. They failed, the courts blocked it from happening, and there is no citizenship question. I want to make that very clear, that there are no questions about citizenship or immigration status, and that the census is completely anonymous. But there's still that chilling effect.
Did you discuss this with Carlos?
Yes, I explained that. And I also explained to him that undercounts could cost California about $1,000 in federal funds a year per person for the next 10 years. Money that goes to important public services like Medi-Cal, public schools. California could also lose representation in Congress, and that's important given the fact that we're currently experiencing record wildfires spurred on by climate change. And so, like, in my best Bocho Spanish, I try to explain all this to Carlos, And that we need, you know, this federal funding to, among other things, fight these effects of climate change. And we need every congressional seat possible to try and reverse it, or at least halt it where it is.
Do you know, Eric, how much success the enumerators have had so far?
The Census Bureau hasn't released LA County's overall response rate after the enumerators began working here last month. Just the self-response rate, which is about 63%. But they've released the overall response rate for the state, which is more than 90%. And that's good news. But with the size of California's population, it still leaves a lot of people undercounted. And we're not sure yet how many people haven't been counted locally.
So what's your takeaway after talking with the folks in Linwood?
On the bright side, that more people have completed their census forms than I would have ever imagined, but that many would not have done it without the help of a census worker. So cutting short that time for census workers to do their job could leave many people in Black and Brown communities undercounted.
That's LAist Eric Galindo. Eric, thanks a lot.
Thank you, A.
For 4 hours today, the civilian commission that oversees the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department debated how to respond to recent events, and some members even called on Sheriff Alex Villanueva to resign. An ad hoc committee will now decide if they should formally call for his resignation. Now, this meeting was taking place just days after two sheriff's deputies were shot in the head while sitting in their patrol car in Compton. Now, both deputies were in critical condition for days. One has been released from the hospital. The shooter has not yet been found. Joining us now is KPCC's Frank Stoltz. He's been covering today's meeting. And Frank, before we get to the hearing, what can you tell us about the search for the shooter who ambushed the two deputies on Saturday night?
Yeah, there have been two interesting developments since the ambush. First, sheriff's officials issued a description of the suspect as a Black man between the ages of 28 and 30. That's a very narrow age range, which could suggest they have a good idea of who they're looking for. Second, detectives say the suspect jumped into a Black four-door sedan, possibly a Mercedes sedan, and they have not ruled out that there was a getaway driver involved. Sheriff Alex Villanueva has only said they have promising leads. This is a massive manhunt, as you can understand, with the FBI and U.S. Marshals Service helping. And, of course, every cop in L.A. on high alert in the wake of the ambush.
Did that ambush come up in that oversight hearing? What was said?
Yeah, it did, right at the beginning. Everybody denounced the shooting, of course, with Commissioner Robert Bonner calling it a despicable act and a low point in L.A. law enforcement history. And he expressed concern about a proposed resolution condemning the attack. Part of the commission's resolution said the residents of Compton deserve to live free of violent incidents that further ignite community trauma. It was a reference, in part, to deputy shootings. Bonner worried about connecting deputy shootings with the ambush.
Certainly, we don't want to say anything or express any sentiment in this resolution that could be mistaken by anyone as ever justifying homicidal attacks or violence on deputies or other police officers.
In the end, the commission included the language. Here's Commissioner Priscilla Ochin.
We aren't here to take sides. We are here to try to build bridges and to come up with solutions. I think that we need to acknowledge the pain and frustration of communities who are being afflicted by conflict violence.
The move infuriated one Altadena resident who tweeted that equating the ambush of the deputies with incidents involving deputies who may be confronted with armed suspects as nonsense.
Now, Frank, didn't Bonner talk about possibly Alex Villanueva resigning? How significant was that?
Well, we have to remind ourselves who Robert Bonner is. He is a former federal judge who once ran the DEA. He is very much pro-law enforcement. But today, he said, with great reluctance, he's taking a step to call on the sheriff's resignation. He said it's become apparent that Sheriff Villanueva lacks the judgment to be sheriff. And he cited a number of things, 10 in all. One was his rehiring of a deputy who had been fired over domestic violence allegations. That deputy had been a political aide to the sheriff. He also cited the policy that Villanueva had written about getting rid of cliques. He said that the sheriff is not enforcing that policy. And finally, he said there's been no sheriff in modern history that has such a bad relationship with the Board of Supervisors. And Bonner said that relation is key to a well-functioning sheriff's department.
All right. Now, the committee also discussed the case of our colleague, KPCC reporter Josie Huang. Now, to remind listeners, while she was covering protests outside the hospital where the deputies were being treated, Josie videotaped the arrest of a protester. Then sheriff's deputies restrained and pinned her to the ground. She was then arrested for obstructing justice. Frank, what did the committee have to say about this?
Again, they expressed a lot of concern. In fact, the commission formally asked Inspector General Max Huntsman to investigate her arrest, something he actually already said he'd do. In comments to the commission, Huntsman said videos he's looked at indicate the deputies wrongfully arrested her. He also said her arrest came in a context. There had been other alleged efforts by deputies to block journalists from doing their job, including an incident where a deputy shined his high-power flashlight into the camera of a Fox 11 reporter in an effort to prevent them from filming an arrest.
My office is investigating recent Sheriff's Department actions which may violate the United States Constitution's guarantee of freedom of the press. In these investigations, we have requested the cooperation of the Sheriff's Department and not received it.
And another incident, where deputies claimed they had been asked by a businessman to clear out civil rights attorneys holding a press conference outside the South LA station. But it turns out the conference was not being held on that businessman's property, according to the inspector general.
Wow. All right. Now, one committee member pointed out that both journalists and protests are protected by the Constitution. And a public commenter called in to ask the committee what the media guidelines are for the sheriff's department. So, Frank, you cover them all the time. What are sheriff's deputies allowed to do and what is not allowed?
Yeah, and you know this too. I mean, the main issue for any law enforcement agency is that reporters do not get in the way of police work, of investigations. They can move you out of any area where you might be stomping on evidence, for instance, or endangering a deputy. But it's always a bit of a give and take. You know, they want you as far away as possible. Reporters want to get as close as possible. Different agencies behave differently. We should point that out. Under Sheriff Villanueva, we see these growing concerns that he is preventing reporters from exercising their First Amendment rights.
All right. Finally, the Civilian Oversight Committee was set up to help with public transparency and accountability with respect to the Sheriff's Department. But the members talked at length today about how they're limited in what they can actually do if the sheriff refuses to cooperate with them. So what are the limits of their power, Frank?
Well, they do have subpoena power. Voters gave it to them in March. But the first subpoena they issued, the sheriff ignored. The sheriff believes this is a biased commission, not supportive of his department. Months ago, he quit sending representatives to the meetings. So the commission is left with the bully pulpit, and that's about it right now. I mean, it's going to be going to court here to try to enforce its subpoena. But for now, really, it's the bully pulpit. And there is this growing concern the department is using excessive force at demonstrations. And of course, we saw a summer of demonstrations. And at the meeting, this came up again and again with people who spoke, including this man who identified himself as TK.
How they opened fire on peaceful protesters with no dispersal orders, no unlawful gathering orders. A 7-year-old was sprayed with pepper balls. Multiple people were hit with rubber bullets.
And again, compounding all of this is the deteriorating relationship between the sheriff and this oversight commission and the inspector general and the Los Angeles County Board of Supervisors. He's really a bit isolated right now. And now there are calls for his resignation from members of the commission. It's not getting any better.
So, Frank, what happens next? I mean, we got into a lot of stuff there, but what happens next?
Well, if you want to do the immediate next, the sheriff holds a news conference this afternoon to talk about a controversial South LA shooting. He's going to answer some of these concerns that we raised today. And there's a court battle over the subpoenas that the commission has issued. So that's what's next.
All right. That's KPCC's Frank Stoltz. Frank, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Los Angeles Unified School District Superintendent Austin Buettner has a lot on his plate, figuring out how to roll out a COVID-19 testing program and also getting pressed by students to defund the school police department. He's going to join us next to tell us how it's all going. That's coming up when Take Two continues. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and on the KPCC app. I'm A. Martinez. It's about a month into the school year, and parents across Los Angeles are still adjusting to kids doing school at home via Zoom. For many, the scenario this fall is going far better than in the spring when the lockdown started, but there are still reports across LA County of kids who don't have devices to do Zoom school or even decent Wi-Fi. And even for those kids with a good computer and a good internet connection, there's still a question of how much they're actually learning in this remote environment. Now, Los Angeles Unified School District has announced an ambitious plan to test all students and staff for COVID-19. It's estimated to cost about $150 million, and it does not mean that schools are going to reopen right away, but it's a big step toward that eventual goal. Here to talk about all of this and more, we have LAUSD Superintendent Austin Buettner on the show. Superintendent Buettner, let's start with the testing program. So what is the goal of this program?
Well, thanks for having me. The goal of the program is to make sure we have the information to isolate those who might have the virus from those who don't and mitigate risk in a school setting so that we can bring students and teachers back to schools in the safest way possible and help keep them there.
Now, how often will staff and students be tested?
We start with a baseline test for each and every one. So every staff member will get a test, every student will get a test, and family members who are living with students or staff who test positive or show symptoms will also be tested. So baseline for all, which will shift to periodic testing, and then as we get closer to the time where overall health conditions in the Los Angeles area are safer. We're still too high. We're still purple on that state report card, which I think is the bad color. As we get to the better colors and it's possible to plan for a return, we'll reestablish a new baseline for all and begin to invite students and staff back in the safest way possible.
When you say a periodic, I know that you haven't quite gotten to the point where you've established that, but any hint, any idea on what that might mean? In other words, how often a week, how often a month?
It'll depend upon several factors. It'll depend upon what the baseline shows us, where prevalence is or isn't. It'll depend upon what the current condition or spread is in particular communities. We serve almost 700,000 students. We've got 75,000 staff all spread across 700 square miles. And the condition in Verdugo Hills might be very different down in the Port of Wilmington. So we'll have to make sure we're leaning into where the virus is more prevalent with more testing. But it'll be quite frequent, and the scientists tell us it will be enough to greatly mitigate the risk.
Now, how are you communicating all of this to families in the district, especially non-English speakers who might not totally trust the system given the current climate?
It's a very good question. We're starting with building from the community. We start this week. We shared what a school report card will look like, exactly how we will communicate how the process works, how the system works in testing, but equally importantly, how we'll share information. And so we've developed, again, a first-in-the-nation effort to show exactly what is occurring at a school and what's not. So not just overall in Wilmington there is more or less COVID. That doesn't help you if you're looking at a particular school. So I was at Harry Bridges Elementary Span School earlier this week for a test. When students are invited back to that school, we will publish a report card which shows which cohort the virus occurred in, if it does occur at that school. We have coding on it. We have green, yellow, red to give a sense of the magnitude, whether there's more than one case or no cases. And we'll also tell those in the school community that it occurred somewhere else. So we want to make sure people understand as much as possible about where COVID is or isn't.
Now, the testing program, Superintendent, how is that getting paid for?
Right now, we're using reserves, dollars that could be allocated for many different purposes. So in effect, we're taking monies we'll need next year or the year after. We believe this is something the federal government should be supporting. And let me put it in context. It'll cost about $300 per student over the course of the year. It'll be free to students. The district's paying for it. about $300 out of the $17,000 the state provides schools in California each year. Now, $17,000 is not enough. You and I, in different form, have had that conversation about the lack of adequacy and the symptoms we see in a class size that's too big, or a school library without a librarian, or students without devices and internet access. But if you look on a national scale, $300 times all students in public schools, roughly $20 billion. A lot of money. But $20 billion in the context of a trillion or two or three that Congress is considering in response to COVID across the nation, I'd make an argument that the need for students to be back where we know the best learning occurs in a school setting in the safest way possible and provide the foundation to reopen the economy, that $20 billion investment at the federal level for all public schools should be top of the list.
Now, Superintendent, if the testing program continues to go exactly as you'd planned, and then say you get the extra cash from the federal government, I would assume all of this is to eventually have kids be back in the classroom. So when would be the estimated timeline for kids to get back inside the classrooms?
As soon as we can do so safely, I wish I could give you a concrete date. But before we can bring students back, the overall health condition in the area has to be appropriate. And right now, Los Angeles, we're still in that purple part of the state report card, which means widespread COVID, the highest level of risk. As that comes down, as health practice across the community continues to be complied with and people put on their masks and do all the things that we can do collectively, we'll set the table or the condition for students to be brought back to schools. And I hope it's as soon as possible. And we're going to do it in the safest manner possible.
Talking to LAUSD Superintendent Austin Buettner now. Let's move on to other topics on your plate. The state of California now allows small groups of high-need students to return to campus for in-person instruction, but LAUSD is not doing that. Instead, it's taking a more narrow approach, allowing for one-on-one tutoring outside. First off, Superintendent, who is doing this tutoring and why this approach?
Our approach, again, is to be careful and deliberate. Careful and deliberate, we believe, will stand the test of time because we don't want to bring students back until we can be assured it's safe and appropriate to do so. So we built the foundation of health practice in all our schools. We are testing students and staff when they come back. So right now we have almost 3,000 children in childcare who are children of our essential workers, those who are working at schools right now. And we've begun bringing students back for one-on-one outside because we know we can do that in as safe a manner as possible. We'll see how that goes. We'll watch experiences elsewhere. But there's no prize for the first. There's no race to be the swiftest only to see it not go well. So safety first, because our goal is to have all students back as soon as we can do so safely.
Teachers Union has been a very, very vocal about its members not returning to school. Do you have the political capital to challenge United Teachers LA on this issue?
Well, there's no challenge. We are looking at it the same way. We talk all the time. All of the decisions we made along the way, they're our partners. They're planning with us on how we go back. And our commitment to all who work in schools is we're going to do it in the safest way possible.
But wouldn't this testing system that you've set up at a significant expense to the district, doesn't that give you some leverage with the teachers union to say, look, we're doing a lot on our end?
Well, it's not a question of leverage, I think. It's a question of what you think is right. And I've told since the inception to all who work in schools, I wouldn't ask you to come back and do something I wouldn't do myself. I'm 60. I'm in a high-risk category. I believe I could be in one of our schools today teaching or working because we've changed the filtration system. We've kept everything clean. We're keeping people apart. I also don't believe we should be in a congregate setting in school yet because there's still too much spread. When that changes, when it comes down, I think we'll have the right set of conditions in place to do it in the safest way possible.
Now, switching gears, the LA School Board met on Tuesday. A lot was discussed. Probably, though, one of the most heated issues was around school police. So let's listen to a clip of Kalia Williams addressing the group on Tuesday night.
What is it going to take for you to realize that police don't make us feel safe? A headstone on the ground with my name on it? My family mourning over my body because of something that could have been fixed? I can think of a million reasons why I have never felt safe with school police. However, your justification will always be school safety and student safety.
Now, over the summer, Superintendent, the board voted to cut funding to the department, but what comes next is a little unclear. So first off, where exactly will these cuts be coming from?
I created a task force early in the summer to look at these issues, to look at what we can do to reform, not just the issue of school police, but how we can make for safer school communities, what we can do for culture and climate in schools to balance the issue raised by the student, very legitimate, which is the perception that she feels in a school. At the same time, we have the responsibility to make sure students are safe in schools. And our schools reflect many, many challenges that a community might face, including overall safety. But we're responsible to keep everybody safe. We have a responsibility to make sure that we respect the views and values of all in the school. We've got a task force working on it. We'll be making some recommendations to the board shortly, and the board will have a chance to opine on that and decide what the next set of steps are.
Well, would you prefer to keep officers, uniformed officers, on campuses?
Well, I think one of the challenges, you mentioned the board voted, it was a 4-3 vote. It was not a 7-0 vote. So there are many voices. What we're doing is we are listening to all of the voices. We have a group of outsiders helping us. We have are surveying those who work at schools, all who work at schools. We're surveying students, high school students in particular, families. We've been speaking with other schools. We're looking very, very carefully at what's in the budget now and how that's used and whether we can substitute other forms for that. But if you just change a uniform, you still have issues about a bomb threat or a threat of a mass shooting, and you have to figure out what's the appropriate way to respond to that. So it will be a balanced answer. Those who are looking for a simple answer probably won't find it in schools. And I think those who want to think about school police in the same category as municipal police, it's a very, very different setting. So I don't think it serves students and the school community well by looking with one broad brush of how law enforcement as a whole needs to reform, because obviously that reform needs to happen.
The $25 million, though, wondering if the district has a plan on how they're planning to relocate that money, because there is an argument for maybe using that money to support students, particularly Black and Brown students. So does the district have a plan on how they're going to go with that money?
Well, we're looking at that as well. And again, we serve Black and Brown students. More than 85% of the students we serve are Black and Brown students. Out of an $8 billion budget, let's not assume a reallocation of a relatively small portion. The school police budget is less than 1% of our overall budget. So reallocating fractions of 1% isn't going to serve the total objective, which is to make sure that every student gets a great education. The culture and climate in our schools is safe and welcoming for all. It's a much, much broader effort and then just looking at a small portion of the budget. But as part of what we'll be bringing forward to the board is the from to, so a reduction which has been mandated by the board, and some thoughts and ideas as to where those dollars could be invested differently in schools.
So it sounds, Superintendent, that you're definitely very big on partnerships and working collaboratively on a lot of things, because when it comes to reimagining school safety task force that you created, there's been a lot of controversy around it because no students have been invited to participate on it. So first, why not, when the outcome of these decisions directly impacts students?
Well, I think that's a little bit of a misstatement. I've met with students. I listen to students. The task force listens to students. We've set up forums. We'll be surveying students and meeting with students. But it's a very small working group of people with a different set of experiences. And the voices of students and families and those who work in schools will be well represented. So everybody's voice will be taken into account. So I don't think it's an accurate statement to say that somehow the voices of students are not represented.
So on not having the students be invited to participate, you're saying that the listening part of it is their participation?
Well, listening is part of the participation. The work they've done, reading the work they've done, listening to their views, looking at the research, it's all part of what we're doing. And I think we owe that respect to everybody in the school community. We could have a task force of 1,000 people. I'm not so sure that that's manageable and that's going to get us the place we need to be. But this is all being done very carefully. It's all being shared very publicly each step along the way, and everyone has a chance to have their views heard and make an input.
Now on this, on the task force and figuring out where the money goes, what's a timeline on that?
An update was shared with the board earlier this week. There will be another board meeting later in the month for more discussion by the board. And my expectation is before students are back in schools, the board will have a chance to opine on this and give us some further direction.
Now, Superintendent, these are extremely fraught times for so many reasons, and you have a huge responsibility to deliver for, 600,000 kids. Just to end this, what can you tell Ms. Williams, the young lady we heard from earlier, and other students maybe, that the district will do everything it can to make them feel safe? Because obviously we heard her emotion there in a clip we played earlier. She doesn't feel safe. So what can you say to make her feel safe?
That's our primary responsibility, not just to her, to her family, to all of our students. So every incident involving safety at schools is reported by a principal or a teacher. And that's what school police respond to. So we have to make sure all voices are heard, and we have to make sure we're looking at the same set of information very, very carefully and figuring out what type of reform is possible to do. But absolutely, I want every student to feel safe and welcome and respected in the school community that they're part of.
Austin Buettner is a superintendent of the Los Angeles Unified School District. Superintendent, thanks for the time.
Appreciate you having me on. Thank you.
For working moms, the road is always tougher. I mean, in just about any and every situation. And right now, many working moms are working from home right next to their kids who are in school. Now, while that applies to a lot of people, whether they have kids or not, for the working moms in particular, that could be hurting their career chances way down the line. We'll tell you how when Take Two continues. Stay with us. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and streaming on the KPCC app. I'm E. Martinez. The coronavirus pandemic is disproportionately impacting working mothers. They're cutting their work hours more so than men or women without children as they spend more time on childcare. KPCC's Mariana Dale reports research indicates this could hurt their careers years down the road.
On June 23rd at 1:35 p.m., Delilah Ballesteros finally sent an email she'd been thinking about for weeks.
After many prayers, I have decided that I won't be returning to work this school year.
The recipient was the principal of Holy Trinity Elementary School in Atwater Village, where she taught fourth and fifth grade.
You know, I would come home and talk about my students, refer to them as my kids. I didn't feel like it was work at all.
Ballesteros also has her own kids, a 4-year-old daughter, an almost 2-year-old son, and another daughter who was just born in December. She planned to return from maternity leave after spring break. Then her daughter's preschool closed, and the family's daycare provider closed for everyone but essential workers.
Who's going to take care of my kids? Is it safe to go back? What's going on? Am I really ready to return? What is that going to look like? Just kind of putting on these questions to myself and my husband, just trying to figure out what would be best for us.
A University of Southern California working paper found more often than not, it's moms who are stepping up to care for their families at the expense of their work. 42% of moms reduced their working hours during the pandemic, compared to 30% of dads. University of Arkansas professor Hema Zamaro is the paper's lead author and a mother.
This has the potential for women to have long-term consequences, because also we know from research that once women leave the labor force, it's very hard for them to come back.
She analyzed data from a national survey that included questions about mental health and found that working moms experienced more symptoms of depression and anxiety than men or women without kids.
My insomnia basically was just at a new level of not being able to sleep at night because I was so uncertain.
Loretta Madrigal is a single mom in West Covina. She alternated between worrying about the coronavirus and how to make ends meet after the swim school where she worked shut down. It reopened this summer, but she's still working way less. Madrigal also thought about trying to find another job, but her son's school and daycare are still closed.
My family's like, you don't have enough hours, but we're sick of watching your kids. And it's like, well, you guys are putting me between a rock and a hard spot, because if I get more hours, then I'm going to be away from them more.
Some researchers believe this push and pull moms feel between caring for their kids and working happens in part because there aren't national policies to support them, like paid parental leave. Caitlin Collins is a professor of sociology at Washington University in St. Louis.
What I try to drive home to women is that this is not their fault. The stress and the overwhelm they feel is not on them to resolve. They're already trying their best.
Instead, Collins looks to men, employers, and the federal government for solutions.
All of us benefit when children are raised well, right? And all of us deserve supports to reconcile work and family.
Back at Delilah Ballesteros' apartment complex in Glendale, the kids chase each other through the courtyard. her 4-year-old daughter, Isla, comes over to say hi.
Do you wish you could go back to school now? Or you like being home now?
I like being home, but I do miss school too.
Ballesteros also misses school. Her feelings about deciding to stay home from work are complicated.
Relief sunk in as a mother. Like, okay, we're home, we're safe here.
She realizes she's luckier than many because she's in a 2-income household. Her husband is a marketing specialist. But there's still guilt. First, for leaving a job she loved, and second, because being a full-time mom to 3 kids under 5 in the middle of a pandemic is really hard.
Should I be happier about this? Should I be enjoying it, you know, more? I do enjoy it, but, like, there should be no but, I feel like.
She's working on letting go of the guilt. Covering early childhood, I'm Mariana Dale.
And Mariana is here to tell us a little bit more about this story. So I know there's concern that women will be either forced out of their jobs or leave because they have more caregiving duties at home. Mariana, as you were talking to moms, did you get a sense of what types of supports were allowing people to go back to work?
Childcare, like 100% it was childcare.
Should have known, of course. Yeah.
You heard from Loretta in the piece, and she talked about even though she had some tension, having her family be able to watch her sons while they did virtual learning was key, but she's still making her own sacrifices, like not signing up for college classes, which is going to delay her career goal of opening her own swim school. And I have another example, Jaylee Marouk. Before the pandemic, she and her boyfriend both worked in the entertainment industry, and it was largely Marouk that took on the childcare responsibilities while her boyfriend drove for Postmates.
He literally just wants to jump on me and crawl on me all day and play and, you know, run around. And, you know, for parents, it's really exhausting.
And Marouk did find a part-time job as a computer technician, and she calculated that the skills she was going to gain from this job were worth what she'd pay for childcare for her 2-year-old son. And she did negotiate with her childcare provider for a lower fee and get some help from her mom to help pay for it. And I think it's really important to know that parents don't just want any childcare. They really want to know that their kids are going to be in a safe, stable environment. Marouk was reassured because the center her son goes to was really clean. Kids were separated into small groups and the staff wore masks.
Now, another idea in the piece is that legislation can create programs to support working families. So can you give us an update on California's family leave policy?
Yeah, just today, actually, Governor Gavin Newsom signed Senate Bill 1383 into law. It's going to take effect next January. What it does is extend job protections for people who work at smaller businesses in the state. Specifically, that bill is going to require any business with at least 5 employees to allow their workers up to 12 weeks of unpaid leave so they can take care of their families. And that time is going to be protected so people won't lose their job, whether they were caring for a child, a sibling, grandparent, domestic partner, or grandchild.
You tell me, Mariana, but that sounds like a big deal.
Yeah, people are really excited about this. California was the first state to implement paid leave back in 2004, but not every worker that contributes has had their job protected. And advocates say that this fear of becoming unemployed is why many of them haven't taken advantage of the program. And advocates have been trying to change this for years.
Mariana, is there anything that didn't make the final story that you wanted to share with us?
Absolutely. There always is. I keep thinking about this woman named Maggie Kelly. She's a high school English teacher in Santa Monica. Her daughter was just born in June, and she was counting on childcare offered on site at her school. The district hasn't reopened these programs, and she doesn't know when they will. So right now, she's trying to figure out if and when she'll return to work. It's a financial calculation for Kelly and many other mothers. They're in households where their husbands make more money than the wives do, but she's also thinking about her values.
I want my daughter to see her mom adding value to this world and being passionate about something outside of the home, because as much as I love her and I'm passionate about her, she needs to see a model for somebody who looks like her doing what they love.
Now, if people want to share their own experiences with childcare right now, is there a way to get in touch with you, Mariana?
Absolutely. In addition to all the usual ways, at the bottom of the story on LAist.com, there's actually a survey. We'd love parents and caregivers to fill it out. And if you do, I might be in touch for a future story.
All right. That's Mariana Dale covering early childhood education. Mariana, thanks a lot.
Thank you for having me.
The Bobcat fire has burned over 50,000 acres and now is threatening the cabins of Big Santa Anita Canyon. Never heard of those cabins? Well, listen up.
All these almost hobbit homes. Picture a glade full of stone wooden cabins scattered throughout the trees.
We'll hear how close the flames are when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and streaming on the KPCC app. I'm E. Martinez. The Bobcat Fire continues to burn above the San Gabriel Valley, threatening homes, structures, and communities. Now, among those communities threatened is the Santa Anita Canyon, a historic area nearly 100 years old. Some residents have been evacuated while others are just struggling to get information and updates. And one of those residents is Ben Fitzsimmons. Ben, so it's my understanding that there are still a lot of questions about the fate of these cabins and the community. So what do you know so far?
Well, we don't know a great deal because obviously the fire is still burning. And there are 81 cabins, some as far in as 4 miles into the canyon. And right now, it is still not safe for us to venture in or even for many of the Forest Service staff. It's really only crucial firefighter teams who are in there, and they have a lot more to do than checking on the cabins. They're trying to put out the fires.
Ben, what's worse? I mean, having the information or being in the dark like this? Because this is, I can imagine that your emotions are going all over the place.
Yes, it is definitely worse not knowing.
Okay.
If we knew whether we still had these historic homes or whether we didn't, we could start making plans going forward, thinking about rebuilding, etc. Right now, we don't know anything. The entire community is just waiting. We're just waiting.
Now, this community has a very deep history in the region. Can you tell us a little bit about it, the history?
Yes, well, the current cabins date back to between 1907 and the mid-1930s. They were developed under the National Forest's recreational residence permit system. Prior to 1915, there were a lot of cabins just being built haphazardly throughout the mountains, the San Gabriel Mountains. And this system sort of created protocols and permits for doing it. And there were more than 200 cabins. It's a little hard to check exactly how many originally because of this previous haphazard building. These days, there are 81 cabins that were the survivors. They're the survivors from two fires and a couple of major floods in the first half of the century.
What do the cabins look like? For people that may not know, Ben, what do the cabins look like? Paint a picture for us.
Well, hopefully some of your listeners have hiked in the Big Santa Anita Canyon. That's through Chantry Flat above Arcadia. But if they haven't hiked in that area, there are all these almost hobbit homes. Picture a glade full of stone wooden cabins scattered throughout the trees. And that really is what we have. Each one is unique. They're all built at the time. Everything is brought in and was and continues to be brought in by donkeys or carried in ourselves. So very traditional building materials. The Forest Service, they are our landlords. They're very strict about the historic nature of these and retaining the essence of these cabins. So there aren't any changes made to the exterior. The paint colors are all historic and approved. So they're these beautiful pieces of history, just little glimpses of history that are out there for people to see.
And if anybody has ever seen them up close, they always come away with just being in love with them. I mean, you just fall in love with them the second you see them. Ben, how was it for you when you first saw them?
The same, exactly the same. You fall in love with them. If you look on Instagram, anytime anybody hikes to Sturdivant Falls, half the photos are not of the forest, they're of the cabins. And so many of us see the cabins, go, oh, I wish I could live in one of those. But we never realize that you can. You can live in them. They're an active community. I've heard so many of the owners of the cabins who say they came across them, started chatting with one of the cabin owners because we're all there most weekends working on our cabins and realizing that they're sometimes available for sale. And I remember hiking to our cabin, what became our cabin. My wife had seen somebody posting it on Facebook, the message that this cabin was available to set for sale. And we hiked in there just really on a whim, just for an excuse to have a hike. And immediately looked across the canyon, saw what became our cabin. And 3 weeks later, we owned it.
Love at first sight. True love at first sight.
Definitely. We were very fortunate. Some cabin owners wait years to find their perfect cabin.
It was meant to be. Yeah, it was meant to be for you, Ben. When it comes to the community that's there, how is this community special? Because the isolation is one thing, the cabins and the way they look is another, but the people that live up there, what makes this community of people special?
Well, the community, as I say, dates back 100 years, slightly more than that. There are cabin owners whose families built the cabins. There's one family, four generations have been using this cabin. 90 years they've been there. There are other cabin owners who have had their cabin for just a couple of months, which makes this time really difficult on both sides. But all of these people have this passion for owning a cabin that you have to hike into, that doesn't have running water, don't have any utilities. They want to be there. So we're all united by this passion for Big Santa Anita Canyon, for the history of the area, for the cabins, which means it doesn't matter what our background is, what our place on the political spectrum. We all socialize together. We get together to work on each other's cabins. If somebody needs a tree cut up because it's fallen or a roof replaced, it's such a close-knit community. Almost like you think of in the past, these communities where people just drop in to see each other. You can't call ahead or send a text to say if you're around. So you just wander over, call over, see if anybody's around. It's wonderful. Some of our best friends are cabin owners. We spend more time in the canyon than we do at home in sort of the regular world, in a regular home. Yeah.
We're talking to Ben Fitzsimmons. He owns a cabin in the historic Santa Anita Canyon area that's being threatened by the Bobcat Fire. Ben, this isn't the first fire, though, that this community has faced. What's happened in the past when it comes to fires?
Well, the last major fire was 1953. It was a fairly dramatic fire. About 35 of the cabins burned down. And as the ones that are there still obviously survived that fire. And then about 10, 12 years later, there were a number of small landslides and floods as a result of that fire. But in the late 60s, there was a big flood that then took out a few of the other cabins. So what remains, they're survivors. They're really survivors. So,
when do you think that you might be up there to see if everything's okay? Any ETA, has anyone told you anything?
Nobody knows and nobody can know. The Forest Service has been wonderful in communicating with us. I'm having regular conversations with our permit administrator. The district ranger joined us. We actually had a regular board meeting scheduled for the day after the fire went sweeping through the canyon. So we obviously changed our agenda. This is the board of the Cabin Owners Association so that we work on things together for the canyon. And the permit administrator joined us on our Zoom call. The district ranger joined, despite the fact that obviously the fire was still burning, was heading to Mount Wilson. So they didn't have any information because they don't know. It's up to the incident commander based on when the fire is safe. We know there are rock slides happening We know that some of the trails are severely damaged. We don't know if any of the buildings have survived.
For someone that, say, Ben, does lose a building, does lose a house, would they be able to rebuild it?
That is a difficult question to answer. As I said, these are on Forest Service land. Mm-hmm. We lease the land but own the homes on the land. However, there are a lot of environmental questions. If a fire has swept through the canyon, is it still safe? As we all know, following the station fire, a number of trails and hiking areas were closed for quite some time while they tried to recover the land. We don't know. The Forest Service has said they will work with us. We know that they're so passionate about these cabins as well. They know how valuable this community is to the canyon. We all love the canyon, not just because of our cabins, but also where it is. We work on the trails. We pick up trash, clean graffiti off, make it a place for everybody. And I'm hoping that that will swing things in our favor to rebuild. Nobody has said we can't rebuild, but we just, nobody knows.
That was Ben Fitzsimmons, a resident of the historic Santa Anita Canyon area that is currently being threatened by the Bobcat Fire. He is also president of the Big Santa Anita Canyon Housing Association. All right, if you missed any part of the show today or any part of the shows this week, just head to wherever you get your podcasts. There we will be waiting to be heard by you. We're also all over social media. We're on Twitter, @Take2. That's @Take2. I'm there as well, @AMartinezLA. That's @AMartinezLA. That's good for Twitter and Instagram. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take 2 is back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.